Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Living and Thriving. Living and Thriving. Living and Thriving with Rusty. Living and Thriving with Rusty.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon to all my blessed beloveds out there in Radio Land. It's Living and Thriving time, and I'm Rusty. I'm so excited. Today is just turned out to be a miracle of all miracles, and my teenage daughter is getting ready to get put in the trunk. She's laughing so hard. We're having a good time. It's my last day in New Hampshire, our last day in New Hampshire, and honestly, I cannot wait to get home. There's a lot that has transpired over the summer, and I've learned a lot, and I'm grateful for all my lessons, and I'm just grateful to move forward. And we are so excited about trying to purchase a house. We are still fundraising to get our down payment, but it's happening. It's going to happen. I know it. I feel it. I'm manifesting it. It's all good. Our future is bright. The radio show is going crazy good. We're actually thinking about adding an additional hour, so it'll be 3 hours a day. I have more requests than I can keep up with, and I could not be more grateful because the people that come on this show are just simply amazing, and they have great stories, and I'm so honored to be able to share in that journey with them and learn and live and thrive. I'm super excited today. I have Michael Black on. He is an author, and he's going to share a really amazing journey of transition and transformation and healing and hope. And I'm really looking forward to talking to him in a moment or so. And I hope that everybody is just thrilled that today is August 1st. And the only reason why I say that is it's a new day, it's a new start, it's a new month, and so many beautiful things are going to happen for everybody. I just feel it in my bones. It's so positive. The weather looks great. The rates for housing interest stuff went down. I'm so excited about that. Trust me, I am excited. And just things are good. And helping other people is good. And I'm hoping that everybody takes 5 minutes longer to get out of bed, as I say every week, and you help somebody else, pay a toll, buy a coffee, you know, give a little kid a high five. I don't know. Just do something fun and helpful to somebody else. That's all I ask. I know I ask a lot. All right. Knock, knock. Michael, are you out there?
Who's there? Rest, can you hear me?
I love Doug. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Gosh, I got to tell you, you are so... listening to you, you're just so uplifting and encouraging. And, you know, I don't doubt that you, like the rest of the population, have down days, but I've been listening to a lot of your interviews, and you just have a special knack for this. And it's, I can see light in your face, even though I know what you look like from online, but you just don't ever lose that. Don't ever lose your lightness, your joy in life. And I love that about you, Rusty. I just wanted to throw that out there real quick. I'm in a real good place.
Oh, big hug, Michael. Thank you so much.
You bet. And thank you for having me on your show. I know you're busy. I've looked at, you know, you've got a pretty full schedule, and I appreciate being a part of it.
Well, I'm so excited to get to know you and learn about you. Mm-hmm. I treat this show as though, and if you've listened to the show, you know, it's just two strangers getting to know each other like strangers should, because I think it's beautiful and miraculous how that opens up and translates into a real authentic conversation. And when I've researched you, I just fell in love with you. You have a great story, and I'm so grateful that you're taking time out to be on my show.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, my story is something that, for myself, it's just my life. You know, it's just what I went through, and it wasn't that miraculous to me until one day, after several days of writing down notes of stuff that came to my mind, which is how my book started. I'll tell you that in 2009, I went through a federal trial against a man who had sexually violated me as a kid. Now, I wasn't in court against him for the crimes committed against me because of the statute of limitations. What I was in court with him for was his being in possession of child pornography. And but while I was in court, you know, it's just, my then therapist said, I want you to just start writing notes. Whatever comes to your mind, just write it down. So I started writing these notes and notes and notes and notes, and a lot of stuff kept coming to my mind. And I realized during that trial that after many years of freedom from this man, that everything wasn't healed up after all. I could see it in my writing. I wrote very boldly. I wrote what was on my mind. If there was a curse word in there, there was a curse word in there. And I realized that I maybe hadn't forgiven quite as much as I thought I had. Though I don't know that everybody deserves forgiveness. But at the end of all that, he went to prison for 5 years. And in those 5 years, a lot happened. But what came from that is I started looking at all these notes of thoughts. And I started piecing them together. You know, they would be from 4 years old up to 25 years old, and what happened when I was 33 years old. So they were all over. So I started piecing like a puzzle these notes together. And I thought, my gosh, I've got something here. This is my story. You know, Kathy Lee Gifford, if you're familiar with her, she has said for years that everybody has a story. And as I was piecing together these pieces of my life, I thought, there's my story. No offense to my therapist I have today, but I sat across from him during the process of writing this book. And I said to him, you know, writing this book, no offense, has been the best therapy I've ever had. But, you know, writing is a journey. But I've learned so much about myself, and there's a lot of issues that maybe I hadn't worked out. And I don't even know if all the issues are worked out in my life. You know, I've still got my ups and my downs, but the book came to me very organically. It is a very telling tale of my life. In fact, my publisher, Covenant Books, had wanted to publish my book as a novel. And I said, no, it's autobiographical. And I think that a lot of the stuff, I think maybe what people see as a lot of stuff that I talk about in the book is talks on subjects that people don't talk about, and it maybe will make people squirm a bit, especially men. You know, I do talk about sex in the book. I'll be straight up with that. Nothing in it is gratuitous. It was all written to paint a picture of where my mind was at the time. I've been through some pretty dark times in my life, but you know, at the time I knew that I was struggling. I just didn't realize until later when I wrote it that how deep in I was. And my readers can find that throughout the book. I think the book leaves a lot of people almost speechless. What I've gotten the most response from the book is that I'm very courageous and brave. And for a bit I thought, that's all you've got for me is I'm courageous and brave. You know, but I'm okay with that. I'm courageous and brave in that I took a step out into the light to shed light on subjects that people don't talk about. And those subjects are, you know, pedophilia. I write about the book that the vast majority of my adolescence until I became 18, I had been sexually violated by 3 different men. I think that the hard part for me writing the book was the fact that I wrote that I enjoyed it. I was sexually violated, but yet I enjoyed it. And that stemmed, I do believe, from not having a father figure around the house. I was born out of wedlock. My biological father wanted nothing to do with me. He had a family that he had raised daughters already and basically walked away from myself. And he and my mom weren't married. So I didn't have that male role model that I could cling to or learn from. I had a stepdad that we didn't get along. But I think that at a young age, and I was 4 years old the first time I was sexually touched or made to touch, and it's written about in the book. I don't know where, I can't remember sometimes where I'm going with thoughts, but you'll read that in the
That's
book.
Okay.
Too.
I'm going to interrupt you to back up a little bit because you went to the end of the book instead of the beginning. So we're going to do the preface of the book. So what is your book title? And where can we find it?
Thank you, Rusty. My book is actually on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com on the internet. And it's titled Happy Endings and a New Beginning. There are a lot of times
so
in our
happy,
life, I think that, yeah.
Happy
Go
Endings
ahead,
and a New Beginning. I'm so excited about that title because I really believe, you know, as a child who was also sexually violated very young, it takes, you know, you have to heal those wounds. You have to go through and deal with those demons. And it takes a lot. It's a lifelong journey to really get good with what happened in the past, no matter what the subject happened. And it's that you're able to articulate your journey. And I'm sure it was a very difficult process.
Yes, ma'am.
Confusing for your childhood.
Yeah. It was very, you know, to back you up there, you said that, you know, people need to heal from it. But I find, especially men who have been sexually violated, don't talk about it. Men are raised, we don't talk about it. I grew up in an era where you don't talk about it. And now I did talk about it, and I didn't talk about it for many years, but, you know, I think that anybody who has been sexually violated, at least for myself, I have freedom from it, but there's still remnants of struggle that I have in my life, I think. And I don't want to blame my unfortunate, what happened to me as unfortunate. I can't continue blaming that. I have to step above it and move forward. But I think anybody, you know, I don't know, maybe you could attest to this. It affects so many areas of your life. Something sparks in a young child, and it really takes a long time to reconcile what just happened. Carry on, Rusty.
No, I wanted to break it down and go a little slower for the audience because it's your story, and I really want to highlight the journey. So
thank you.
Talk to me a little bit about, I mean, you grew up in the Midwest in a small town. You probably didn't really raise your hand and say, hello, this person's touching me or making me touch them.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me correct you on that. I'm a native to California, Northern California.
Oh.
I was born in Southern California. I was raised in Northern California. I moved back to the Southern California as an adult, and I moved to the Bay Area, San Jose, which is about an hour from San Francisco. I've lived all over in California.
For some reason, I thought it was like a small town. You were in a small town out Midwest. I must have got you confused with somebody else. See what happens when you have all these shows?
No, that's funny. I haven't lived in the Midwest. I have relatives in the Midwest, but I do write in the book that at a young age, my family, my mother and new stepdad had found God, and they moved to a very kind of the Bible Belt, I guess you'd say, of California. It's a very Republican. I mean, there's a strong faith in this town, but I moved to a relatively small town that now has, after, you know, as long as 40 years, has grown significantly. But yeah, I grew up in an era where you just didn't talk about it. And I was told by two of my pedophiles, don't say a peep, and I didn't. But then I think I struggled as well, Rusty, with the fact that I liked it. And I think any attention, when you're lacking it, is good attention. You know, that's my thought that I was probably thinking, I was getting attention. But yeah, at such a young age, I believe, and you can probably attest this, it really affects and I hate this word, the victim. What else can I tell you, Rusty? I could go on and on for days.
No, I know. So you grew up in California. Now, you said you had multiple pedophiles. What were
three.
They from church, from school? Were they family friends? Like, how does that happen?
First time I was touched, or what was made to touch, I was 4 years old, and it was the boyfriend of my aunt, my mom's older sister's boyfriend, who had three kids as well. She had three kids, her sister. And the second one was after we had Northern California. First happened in Southern California. Second happened in Northern California. There was a man who within our church who also worked with my stepdad at the post office. He'd become an uncle of sorts, and there wasn't ever anything weird about the relationship, but he did ask my parents, mind you, this was in the 70s, could he take me on vacation with him? He was a single man, probably in his latter 20s. I was probably 10, maybe 11. And on that trip, too, we went to San Diego, and in the motel room that night, stuff happened. And stuff happened for until I became to the age of majority, meaning when I became an adult. I walked away, obviously. I went away to college. And I kept that in me for years. The third man was actually from the same church. It's a big, what they call a mega church. It was a mega church in town. Everybody knew that church. And he and I, by this time, I was, you know, Rusty, let me say that every time I felt like a willing participant. And that's the part that I struggled with. Why did I like it so much? But the third one, I remember sitting in the balcony of the church to watch. They were playing a movie that night. I was about 15, maybe 16 years old. I knew what I was doing. And I sat next to this man, and before I knew it, he had his hands on me. I had my hands on him. We never pulled down our pants or anything. I think I write about that in the book. I didn't do that in church. But, you know, we ended up going back to his house that night and had full-on sex. Mind you, I'm 15 or 16. And that happened
So this is going to be kind of a controversial question. Do not take me offensively, and I apologize. But do you think that you were always gay, and that's why? Like, I think some people are born gay, and I think some people choose because of their own issues, like sexual abuse, for example, that usually makes women not want to be with men. I don't have a male perspective on sexual abuse, but do you think that you were always gay, and that's why it felt okay?
Well, let me give you it's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I've always believed that though I am a man of faith, and though it was never preached this way, and it wasn't the way in which I was brought up, I do believe people are born gay. I also believe that. I believe a lot of people, and I think probably the instance with me, that a lot of people fall into it. I fell into it because it was comfortable for me. The first person that touched me was a man. That's what I was introduced to. So I became comfortable with it. I think I fell into it because I was looking for that attention. I knew I could find it with men. So I think that people, yes, I do believe people are born gay. In fact, I had a first cousin, whose son I knew at a very young age, and I write about it in the book as well. I knew he was gay. And I also knew he'd never been touched. So I knew he didn't fall into it. I just knew he was going to be gay. Today, he's a very happily 33-year-old gay man who's had the same boyfriend for a long time. You know, it is very controversial. In fact, not accepted in the faith community, because I've heard it said, trust me, many times people say, well, God doesn't make mistakes. And you're right, he doesn't. God has, I think that we're all built differently. And, you know, it's how we come to a peace in our heart. You know, everybody's got different life paths. You've had your life path. By the way, congratulations. I've read a little bit up on you, and you're going to change the world. You're already doing it, Christine.
Thank you, Michael.
Yes, I do believe that people can be born gay. I do believe a lot of people fall into the lifestyle. I find it because I've been part of the gay communities, and I have had lesbian friends, still have lesbian friends. And I find a vast majority, it's primarily women who are so hurt by men or have been abused by men that they fall into the arms of a woman and they call themselves gay.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yes.
Right.
And that's okay. That's okay. So I'm never judgmental about it. I will say this. I married at 23. I married a woman, and it's written about in the book. It was the worst mistake, in my opinion, one of the worst mistakes I ever made in my life. I knew the moment I said I do, I knew that I didn't. And we ended up splitting up relatively quick. The marriage was consummated. But she was somebody I knew for many years of my life. And then the relationship turned sour. I took responsibility for that because I thought by marrying a woman, it would change me. I would suddenly have these feelings towards women, which I had sexually been with women, but it was never my thing.
Right.
So we split up, and I thought, I need to start living in my truth. So we the day our divorce was final, I went to a gay bar, and I remember walking, it's written about in the book, Happy Endings and a New Beginning. Went into a gay bar, known gay bar, I was now living in San Jose. It was a leather night. I'm not a leather kind of person, but I knew I could find a piece of tail there. And I remember going up to the bar, ordering a drink. I'd never been in the bar before. It was packed. And I got my drink. The bartender said, hi. He introduced himself. He said, are you here celebrating anything? I looked at him. I said, yeah, my divorce is final, and I'm gay. It was my kind of coming out. I got a little toasted that night. I think another downfall of the abuse that I endured for many years is not being able to emotionally handle it. And I will say that at 19, working a very good job, I began a 14-year love affair with drugs. Being at that bar, being a working addict, I was high. I was drunk, but I remember looking across the bar, and I like to compare it to, if you know anything about the Bible, about the Red Sea, that God parted the Red Sea. He parted the ocean in half, and people were able to walk through. And I like to tell people that while standing at the bar, I looked across the bar, and it was as though everybody just kind of stood to the side, but there he was, and I saw this incredibly handsome Hispanic man. You got to pardon that. If you can hear the airplane is flying over, I do apologize. I made my way to this gorgeous man. He made his way to me, and we ended up spending the next 4 years together. It was a good relationship. There was a lot of jealousy involved. About 2 years into the relationship, he came home from a routine. Just give you a little snippet here. He came home from a routine doctor visit, and he had me sit down on the couch, and he told me that he learned that day that he was HIV positive. Now we had been having unsafe sex for 2 years. I knew that when we met, though there were a few that snuck in there, I had a clean bill of health. When I got married the year prior, I had to have, back then, you had to have premarital blood work for full disclosure. But I knew that according to my last lab work, I was HIV negative. So our focus came down to him. He, of course, said, you need to go get checked. I went and got checked, not having a doctor at the time. Went to the local clinic, and back in the 90s, early 90s, it took forever to get an HIV test. I mean, like weeks. But I remember going back for my results alone without my boyfriend. And thankfully, I got the news that I was still HIV negative. How? I don't know. But, of course, we started using condoms right away. But it was about a year. Well, I can tell you when. It was November of 1992. I was working my office job. I had a really good job working for a hospital. And I... I knew that I had a pimple on my neck. Anybody who meets me knows that I'd struggled with acne. It's just part of my being. But I had what
right.
I thought was a pimple on the side of my neck. My boss, a registered nurse, went walking by my office, and she says, "Hey, I've been noticing that thing there on your neck." I said, "Yeah." She says, "You should go get that checked out. It doesn't look right." I said, "Oh, her name's Marianne." I said, "Marianne, it's fine. It's just a pimple. I've been treating it as such." She goes, "Okay, but keep an eye on it." Well, it wasn't getting any smaller. She came by my office another day, a few days later, and she goes, "No, really, I think you need to go have that checked," and gave me the name of a doctor. So to appease her, I went to the doctor. They did a biopsy. And fairly quickly thereafter, the doctor called me at work. And I like to tell my reader, I like to let my listeners know that when a doctor calls you and says, "You need to come in, we need to talk," probably not good news. But I took it as, okay, well, I'll be right in. Just not really thinking much about it. Well, then HIV wasn't even on the brain. I was certain it was just a pimple. When it was going to go into his office, let my boss know, and she said, "Let me go with you." And I said, "Oh, well, I'll be fine. No worries. I'll be run over and come right back." She says, "No, really, let me go with you." She knew something I didn't know. We went to the doctors together. I remember her sitting to my right. I was on her left. She reached over and grabbed my hand, and the doctor proceeded to tell me, "Michael," he said, "I have bad news to tell you, and that is that you have AIDS-related non-Hodgkin's lymphoma."
Oh, Jesus.
I didn't have HIV. I had full-blown AIDS. As well, I had cancer.
Oh, my God.
I remember, I was also a nicotine smoker at the time, and I remember first thing saying to him, "I guess I need to stop smoking." He discouraged me. He said, no. He says, "I don't want you to stress your body out any more than it already is." So I eventually quit years later. But, I went through about 4 months of fairly aggressive chemotherapy. But it was during those months of chemotherapy, my then boyfriend and I, we lived a good life. We both made good money. We had no children. We had maid service, we had laundry service, we were spoiled.
Right.
But we've spoiled ourselves. But this particular day, oftentimes during the chemo process, I'd have to have spinal taps, where is much like an epidural women would know of.
Yeah.
They stick a big needle in your back, and what they do is they draw fluid out of it. But after my spinal taps, my doctor said that I needed to go home and lay flat for so many hours. So I would do that. Well, after one particular spinal tap, I went home and I was able to work from home. I laid flat on my couch with my laptop. This great, I like to tell people, it was a great big box with a cord that ran from the box all the way to the telephone line. And back then it was called a dialing in. So I was able
yeah.
to work from home. There was one particular day, I was feeling a little bit better. So I got up just to kind of tidy up the house. There was papers sitting around that needed to be filed. There was papers of my boyfriend's that needed to be filed. I thought I knew where they went, so I got into his filing cabinet. Now, I want to let you know, Rusty, I'm not a nosy person. Never have
right.
been. I don't have to look at stuff. But as I'm putting away his papers, I found a pink piece of paper in his filing cabinet that drew some interest. I'm just curious. So I pulled this pink piece of paper out. The pink piece of paper was not a big deal normally. It was just a citation. So he had been written up by the authorities for peeing in public. Now, as a man, and I think a lot of men can attest to this, it's easy. It's easy to pee in public. You know, just go behind a tree. He apparently was at a bar, same bar in which we met. Bathroom was probably full, very common at bars for restrooms. He probably just thought, I'll sneak outside and pee. He peed alongside the building and got caught. It wasn't a big deal to me because I've done it, you know, I did not along a bar, but I've peed in front of it.
Right.
The big deal to me was that the night that we had met, we had talked about a lot of personal stuff. We ended up bar hopping that night and just getting to know each other. And I went home with him that night. And as I said, we spent 4 years together. It wasn't a big deal to me that he peed, you know, got peed and got caught. The ticket itself wasn't a big deal. The deal was that, why didn't you mention, it seems like you would have at least mentioned this when we met. You never mentioned it throughout the time that we were together. And it drew interest in my head. So I thought, I felt like I had been lied to. So I thought, I'm going to dig further. And I did. I dug further through his paperwork. And it was there that I found lab work from prior to our meeting that indicated he was HIV positive.
Oh, no.
Now, in my group, I got to tell you, in my book, I do refer to myself as a whore. I have been a past whore. I've been in and out of many beds. But this pointed to, he lied to me, you know, so that I could easily, trust me, it didn't come overnight. It took me years to reconcile that of my being a whore, to really looking at myself and saying, I was a whore before I met him and after I met him, but I also know that HIV or AIDS can lay dormant in somebody's system for how long, I don't know. How I went from being HIV negative to full-blown AIDS in a matter of, you know, short time, 4 years, is mind-boggling to me. But I've had to reconcile that and let go of the any question that possibly he infected me because of my past. So, you know, yeah, that's in the book. Now, he ended up eventually, and it's written about in the book, he passes. And I don't know, I find the book to be a good read, a really good read, a page-turner, in fact. However, I'm also very aware it's my own story, you know, and it's I don't know that it's for everybody. I think men will have a hard time reading it. I talk about
my question to you, Michael, and we're going to just back up a little bit, and if it gets too uncomfortable, just, you know, say uncle, because we can change something. So let's back up. So your partner of 4 years who you love, you guys were monogamous with each other?
We were monogamous until everything went awry. After the paper I found.
Okay.
You know, that
so
he
for, but before the paper, you guys were monogamous with each other as far as
very
you.
Very monogamous. Very jealous. Very jealous relationship. I was monogamous, and I believed he was too. Monogamy.
But he
monogamy,
never told you, he never told you that he had AIDS in the beginning. Now you've come down with AIDS and cancer.
He did not disclose. I asked before we went at it. We'd gone back to his apartment.
Yeah.
Had a drink, started messing around, and I had the forethought. I was a little wasted, but I remember having the forethought because AIDS was on the rampage back then.
Yeah.
And I was having gay sex. I knew I would be at risk. And I remember where I was in his apartment, where we were. And I said, stop, before this gets started, what is your status? Now, status in the gay world, or even in any world, people know that it means, are you HIV positive or are you HIV negative? He told me he was negative. I told him, according to my last blood work, I was negative. And we went at it all night like rabbits. But, you know, he lied to me about that because I ended up finding lab work that he was HIV positive prior to our meeting. And I felt very betrayed. So, yeah.
Boy, that must have been really hard to get over, especially considering, you know, this is the love of your life at that point. Like,
it was devastating, you know, and in it, I had already, I felt, I thought I had found the one, this is the one. And I held my then boyfriend. You can find him in the book. I will say there are no names in the book, Rusty. I didn't know that I could do it. I would gave people nicknames. And this particular man, he's my hot tamale. He was a Hispanic man. But to hold my hot tamale in such high regard, he is a little older than me. He was very much like a mentor. I learned a lot from the man. I'm not saying the whole relationship was sour. We had good times. And I'm not talking about sex. We had a lot of, he opened my eyes to culture. I just moved to the Bay Area. He introduced me to the Bay Area. And then all of a sudden, one day, at your weakest, you're going through chemotherapy and having spinal taps. You find this devastating news that he had lied to you about something so important. It demolished our relationship. Yeah. I do write in the book that I stayed with him for another year and a half, I think it was, because I felt like a tainted piece of trash that nobody would ever want me. So why leave him? So I stayed in the relationship for a year and a half, continually telling him, I'm going to leave you one day. I'm going to leave you one day. Back to your question, at that point, we started bringing others into our bedroom.
Gotcha.
And it was rebellious of me. You know, it was more of a, sadly, making each other jealous. I don't go into that so much in the book. But that said, we were not monogamous after that. It was kind of a tit for tat. If he would do something, I'd do something. It just turned volatile and ugly. And I will tell you, we were in a physical fight at one point in the relationship because there was a lot of anger on my part. And we had gone to Hawaii, and it was the first day there. I was on the phone with my best friend, and I remember I write about it in the book. We went at it, not sexually, but physically. My best friend could hear it all on the phone. But the remainder of that trip, you could have seen him in every picture of his. He had sunglasses on because he had a black eye. It turned volatile real quick. Lying is, I think I've spent a lot of my life covering up, you know, my sex capades, as I call them, a lot of shame. But my hot tamale, I held him in high regard, and he kind of exploded my idea of love. So I don't know if I answered your question, Rusty.
You partially did. I just, my heart breaks for you because you ended up contracting something that you might not have otherwise contracted and getting very ill because of somebody's carelessness. And I don't know how you recover from that. I just, with all the forgiveness in the world, I just don't know how a person would recover.
Well, there's a lot of, let me say first, there's a lot of stuff I didn't write in the book because I could have written easily a 500-page autobiography. I'm just a little marshal out in the world. Who's going to want to read my book? But, you know, I held bitterness. My drug addiction became more and more. Shortly after we split, like February of 1994, and I became disabled, completely disabled by April 1st of 1994. I left my job, and I haven't worked since. My numbers, when it comes to AIDS, had plummeted because of my chemotherapy. I was in bad shape.
Right.
But a few months after I became disabled, I ended up leaving him when we broke up. I moved into a small studio apartment, and I stressed to our friends, do not let him know where I live. I was very, again, secretive of where I live because I didn't want anything to do with him. I finally got up the courage to leave him, and I didn't want him following me or trying to change that. But I'll tell you, one late night while at my apartment, somebody knocked at my door, and I opened it up, and there he was, my hot, not so hot tamale. AIDS had quickly creeped in on him. He was a marked man. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, and I strongly encourage you and your listeners to, if they're able to, and they can maybe relate a little bit to the struggle of living with AIDS. But there's a movie called Philadelphia with Tom Hanks. He, I think he won an Academy Award for it. It came out, I think, the same year I was diagnosed in 1992, coincidentally. But there's a scene in it where Tom Hanks has purple blotches all over his body. They are called, and I can't think of the long name for it, but the simple term is KS lesions. It's a cancer sort that attaches to your skin, and you're a marked person, and you can walk by somebody on the street or at the mall with those lesions, and I know exactly what's going on. But my not-so-hot tamale showed up at the door and had those KS lesions, and I welcomed him in, and he begged and pleaded, please take him back, and I just can't. I think we went back and forth. He had lost a ton of weight. He was on his way out. This isn't the best thing. It's just what happened. But I had him. He spent the night that night with me. The next morning came, and I opened the door and sent him on his way, never to see him again. I got a call on June the 4th, 1994, early morning call, that my hot tamale had passed away. And I want to say that the reason I told you all that is because you can't harbor, in my opinion, I can't harbor ill feelings and towards somebody that's not even here. You know, he has no influence on my life. So, I went through some horrible times. And I'll tell you, I ended up going to his graveside at one point, and not so nice of me. I'm just keeping it real here, but I was still so much anger. I even hate saying this. It sounds horrible, but I pissed on his grave. And it felt, kind of felt freeing, just like, take that. But since that time, I have to tell you, Rusty, I've forgiven. I've had to move past it. I can't hold that inside, otherwise it'll kill me.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. I don't think it's a bad thing that you pissed on his grave personally. I probably would have.
Thank you.
I would have been mad. Lord.
Yeah.
But that's a woman's perspective, because we tend to hold grudges longer than most.
Well, but here's the truth as well. Here's the truth. I had to go to the bathroom bad, and there was none around. So I thought, here we go. And it goes back to that. I peed in public.
King paper. It goes right back to the king paper, huh?
Yeah, thank you for your kind word. What else can
so
I tell you
what,
about?
What is your cancer status now? How is that working for you?
I'm so incredibly grateful and thankful to be living in this time. I am proudly a survivor of AIDS and cancer. After 4 months of chemotherapy, my cancer went into remission. Anybody who knows or has bad cancer, after you've been received a no detection of cancer for 5 years, the marker, then you're considered completely cancer-free. I did pass my five-year mark, and now, it's been 1993, I've been cancer-free. It's a wonderful thing.
Yay!
When my doctor
that was
told
the
me
cancer?
That
was the cancer caused? Was the cancer caused by AIDS, or was it just serendipitous?
You know, AIDS. AIDS comes in many forms. There's KS lesions, as I just talked about, with the blotches on them. I happened to infected my bloodstream somehow, and it was an AIDS related cancer. So I not had AIDS. But 4 months of chemotherapy, I remember the doctor telling me the news that I was cancer-free, which I should be elated and just overjoyed about, but I still had AIDS. And mind you, this was the early 1990s. My friends, my people, acquaintances were dropping off like flies left and right. And I was in the Bay Area.
Yeah, that was a terrible time. Yep.
Yeah, the Bay Area, as many people, at least in California, know, is kind of a gay capital. Though AIDS and HIV is not a gay disease, especially these days, you recognize people dropping off or not showing up, and it's scary. because I had eights. Aces is the last hurrah before you check out. So, you know, I think you're given two. You can do one of two things when you receive a life-threatening illness, in my opinion. I could either go back and make right all my wrongs. I'd wronged a few people and just live my best life until I die. Or being the addict I was, I could party like a rock star. I wasn't working and just keep partying until I die. Sadly, I chose the latter. And my doctor, I remember he and I sitting in the exam room. My numbers were really low with AIDS. And I remember asking him a question that I do not recommend, and most doctors will not give you an answer. I'm very stubborn, and I remember sitting in that exam room for some time until he told me, I asked him his professional opinion, how long do you think I have to live? He wouldn't give it to me, and then finally he said, okay, you really want to know? He believed in his professional opinion I had 4 to 6 months to live. Now, that's a tough one to take. But 4 months came, 6 months came, a year came, 5 years came. That doctor's wrong. You know, I'm not seeing him anymore. I'm in a different region of the state. But I'm still here, and it's, you know, it's not been easy. I've been hospitalized a couple times, but I think I'm past the brunt of it, if you will. Doctor, he said, my current doctor has told me, and I've been seeing him for many years, has told me if I continue taking my medication the way I'm supposed to, I can believe that I will live that of a regular lifespan of a man. He does not believe I'm in any imminent danger as long as I keep taking my medication. Trust me, Rusty, it's a lot of medication too, because AIDS, there's a lot of side effects from AIDS. For one, I've had diabetes. It's a side effect of one of the medications I took for years. I take a handful of pills in the morning and a handful at night. And a lot of those are pain pills because I have a lot of pain throughout my body. That's another whole story, another book that I'm struggling with. I'm fighting with a drug maker right now because the drug that they had provided me for years, I was thinking it was helping me, and it has helped my blood, but it's torn down my body.
Right.
I don't know, living with AIDS and HIV these days, and I plan on talking about this, but it's a manageable disease. And I don't talk about this in the book, but if I were to have sex with somebody, unsafe sex with somebody, they'd be okay if it was unprotected. Because of my blood counts and the way they are, they're considered non-detectable. That means that when they look at them in the, petri dish, or they can't find any sign of it. But it doesn't make me AIDS-free. What it makes me is undetectable, meaning that they just can't find it, and it's not going to harm anybody should it get into them, or, you know, however that works. Now, what else you got for me, Rusty? I really enjoyed talking to you. I didn't realize I was going to talk so much.
No, I think it's good. That's how we all learn. So we are actually at the end of the show. So where can we find your book? And give us the title again.
It's Happy Endings and a New Beginning by Michael Black, Michael J. Black. And you can find it on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Now, are you doing any speaking engagements? I know that you're just hitting the podcast circle. Are you doing any speaking engagements? Are you doing any conferences or anything?
Well, even prior to the book coming out, I have been speaking at two colleges in particular in the town in which I live. It's the only place I'm speaking thus far. My dream, my goal is to go on the speaking circuit. I think I've got a story that would resonate with some people and, you know, maybe be able to help someone or help themselves. I will say I'm kind of technologically challenged. I'm older. I don't know how old you are, Rusty. You don't need to display that on air, but I'm 54. So I like to tell people
I'm 11 years younger.
Oh, here, I can do the math. you know, it's my dream is to go out on this public speaking circuit and maybe sell my book along the way with it, because they go hand in hand. I've been speaking at colleges long before the book came along. In fact, my speaking engagements have helped me with the book. But yes, nice. I speak at two colleges here, as well as I have book signings. I've had 7 scheduled thus far. They're all in California, either at a Barnes & Noble, or I have one at a University of California, Irvine. I can't remember that date. I do have them written down. But, you know, I'm getting out there meeting people, and it's a little daunting because my story is different. And not everybody's going to be okay talking about gay sex or homosexuality or pedophilia or, you know, a lot of subjects in the book are touchy. I like to tell in close, I like to let my reader know that if you can get through the tough parts of the book, the ones I just mentioned, I do believe there's a treasure in the book for everybody. I speak on the process of aging, of caregiving. You know, it's not just all AIDS or gay written. In fact, there's an element of faith in it. I don't shove God down your throat, but I share a little bit of my life in there. So I hope my reader will pick up my book. It's an excellent read, in my opinion. It's, again, by Michael J. Black. And it's Happy Endings and a New Beginning. I will tell you this, just a little heads up, there is a happy ending in the book, okay?
Well, Michael, you are the happy ending in the book. Look at how far you've come. Everything you've gone through, you're still out there and you're still helping people have faith in themselves. And that is the happiest ending I can find.
Oh, you're the best, Rusty. Thank you for that. Very kind.
Hey, now, Michael, did you end up sobering up and not partying as much? Do you think that helped you?
Oh, yeah. I'm a firm believer that we addicts, I think when you take your first line of cocaine or your first line of meth or pop your first pill, I think it stunts your growth. I think that most people stop at that age with maturity. I started at 19 and I continued with drugs, alcohol, and nicotine were my choice of stuff. And at 33, I became horribly ill. I ended up being in the hospital in our hometown for a bit and then transferred to UC Davis, which is a big place. I was there for 18 days. My family really didn't know what was going on. I saw my sheets turn brown and yellow and just all the toxins coming out of them. But I was able to do it without methadone or any type of recovery. The part of the book, I do believe that God, in his infinite wisdom, reached down and just took my addiction from me. How I did it, I don't know. I don't consider myself a strong person, but I walked away from drugs, alcohol, and nicotine and never looked back. I know that if I can do it, anybody can do it, because I am not a strong person. However, I'll say there has been a time in my life fairly recently that I've taken OxyContin, a very strong opiate. And my doctor was shocked. I took myself off of them, and I told him I don't want any more. Just because I think opiates are a deadly disease, especially for addicts. And I know my limitations as an addict, if that makes any sense.
Michael, you are a hero. Thank you so much for sharing your story. A harsh, amazing journey, and I love how you're blunt about it and you're real about it. And, you know, good for you for writing the book. And I'm so psyched to hear that you're on a speaking circuit in California right now. So everybody check out Michael J. Black.
Yeah.
Are there
happy
any
endings
last
and new beginnings.
Are there any last words that you would like the audience to take away from today's show? Is there something really important that you want to say?
Well, I'm going to read just a little piece here, and this is my lasting words to people. If you have suffered through the torment of abuse of any kind, I dedicate this book, Happy Endings and a New Beginning, to you. I pray you find healing and solace throughout the pages herein, and know you are never alone. May you find healing and an ability to reconcile the vile act or acts committed against you. As well, may you find the courage and strength to rise above the pain and press forward. Enjoy your life. You only have one. Don't let somebody else steal your joy. Thank
Amen.
You, Lexi, for this time.
Like, you're welcome, yeah, Michael.
Thank Woo-hoo! You, Lexi. Hey, I want to keep in touch with you just because I think you're an awesome woman and a great mentor, too. Somebody that I look up to. You may not know that, but you know it now.
Thank you. I'm very humbled by that. And absolutely keep in touch with me. I want to learn more about how you grow. And thank you
okay,
for
thank you,
that
Lexi.
You do.
God bless. Thank All you right. so much. And thank you, audience, for listening.
Big hug.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty, and I'm Rusty, and that was Michael J. Black, and he wrote a book, Happy Endings, New Beginnings, and I think you absolutely should go out and read that. Read it, buy it, give it to a friend, and understand what the life would be like if you had AIDS and cancer and found out that your partner was not completely honest with you and you were sexually abused. You know, life has a series of twists and turns, and I do not in any way, shape, or form believe that we are not put on those paths for a reason. And Michael's reason is very clear. He had to write this book and he had to share his story.
You're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty.